hello, and welcome to another episode of Assignment Radio, KGOU's bi-monthly student-produced news magazine. In every episode, we bring you stories on a different theme. Last time, we took you to some really interesting events in the community. This week, our stories focus on hard news topics like environmental conservation and the war on drugs. I'm Meredith Everett. Copyright law. It is a contentious issue. It's one of those things that comes up at a party or at work and immediately draws lines between people. Regardless of your stance on the issue, it is still currently illegal. And the entertainment and tech industries are being faced with the challenge of how to monitor and control the practice. In our first story, Assignment Radio's Brett Kopenbarger heads to one of the many front lines of this war, a college campus.
Hey, first I'll start by opening up the transmission torrent client on my computer, which is used to download the torrents from the illegal websites, I guess. And here I'll open up the website. Here I'll double click on a file that I want to share. And it pops up in the torrent client. And here it says it'll take about 2 minutes to download. Once that's done, I'll just drag it and drop it to the iTunes, and then it should be on my computer.
What you just heard was the step-by-step process that Jake took to download music illegally, which is better known as file sharing. It is illegal to copy or share copyrighted material over the internet. This past week in Washington, the copyright alert system went into effect, with an attempt to stop file sharing altogether. This Copyright Act, going into place, will give the user 6 warnings to stop file sharing until more drastic measures will be used. Basically, a strike system like used in baseball. Students at the University of Oklahoma are used to a system like this. University of Oklahoma IT worker Scott Wright explains.
OUIT's role in file sharing, illegal file sharing, really what we do is respond to requests that we receive from either the RIAA or MPAA. As a university and as an entity, we do not track file sharing by students.
In the past year, Scott says that the numbers have decreased a little bit.
For 2012, we received approximately 75 notifications. And so far for 2013, we've received 15 notifications.
In the same way that the copyright alert system works for people in the United States, the one implemented at OU will give you multiple warnings before there's actually any real punishment. One thing the students will have to do is take an educational tutorial.
To receive a notification, we are required to block that system from the network. So we receive a notice, we determine, and that has an IP address, so we map that IP address back to a specific host on the network and block that host. And then once a host is blocked, the individual is required to go back through a quiz and tutorial, which is geared towards education about illegal file sharing.
Before the plan went into effect at the University of Oklahoma, file sharing was at an all-time high. In order for it all to work, every student had to register their laptops or tablets so they could be traced if they were participating in illegal sharing.
Our peak was in 2009 timeframe, and there were over 300 notices per year. So we've seen a significant decline over time. And so I think partly that is due to our education efforts, certainly. And what we also did to help mitigate that risk to our students was we began blocking file sharing in the dorms and on Wi-Fi. So if you're on the wireless network, you cannot do any file sharing outside of OU.
This plan to block file sharing on OU's network seems to be working. Jake doesn't even bother trying to file share on OU's network.
I find that the OU Wi-Fi will block out most torrent websites and other file sharing websites I usually use. So I'll just use my home Wi-Fi network.
But if people file share music, there's a possibility that they are file sharing other things as well. Jake explains.
I download movies from time to time. If I see one that I really like, I may wait a couple weeks after it's been in theaters, and then I'll go on to my torrent or file sharing websites and try to download it. But yeah, it's mostly music.
I asked Jake if he ever felt bad about file sharing.
Yeah, I've done it for so long, and I've heard about all the possible, I guess, legal consequences of it. But I've just never really paid attention because you kind of think, oh, I'm not going to get caught, but you keep hearing stories about how other people get caught.
For Assignment Radio, I'm Brett Kopenbarger.
Like illegal file sharing, sex is a controversial topic on campuses across the country. Recently, some OU students have called for a sex ed class offering on campus, but the idea has been met with some resistance. Whether they're having it or not, are students armed with the facts about sex? Assignment Radio reporter Brant Morrell investigates what the University of Oklahoma is doing to promote sexual health and awareness.
On Joe Sangerardi's desk in the first floor of the Conoco Student Leadership Center of the Oklahoma Memorial Union, there's a pineapple-sized jar, and it's full of condoms.
My friends think it's really funny to have them around here, and I joke that it's, you know, like candy for college kids.
Sangerardi's candy jar is one of many places around campus where students can pick up protection. The efforts of the Student Government Association may not be enough. The condom manufacturer Trojan ranked OU 85th out of 141 in its most recent sexual health report card. The report takes into account 11 different factors, including condom availability, STD and HIV testing, and the quality of sexual health resources.
You know, I had two initial reactions. My first was just kind of like an emotional, like kind of like questioning what's going on. And the other one was a much more educated response that came after I actually analyzed the survey.
A year ago, the report positioned OU at 65th, the best ranking for the university the last 5 years. They dropped 20 spots over the last year.
My reaction was actually, how is it that we've dropped 20 rank spots when we've actually increased the amount of program and accessibility to sexual health programs and supplies? I mean, doubly or triply over the last year.
Even though the OU Board of Regents approved a 9.6% increase to the funding of the Women's Outreach Center last March, Sangerardi still sees a lack of sexual education before students attend college.
I think at OU we do a really wonderful job at teaching sexual health. I think the difficulty we would have here is that maybe in a state like this, where sex ed is a much more contentious debate in the public education school before college, I think it's very possible that we have a lot more people coming through the university who've never actually formally had sex ed.
That's because current education laws in Oklahoma do not require it. And if it's taught voluntarily, it's usually abstinence only.
I would say that the majority of the students that I have in my class really didn't get high school sex ed.
Terry Dennison teaches human sexuality at OU.
They're coming into the picture with a real deficit of how to handle sexuality at this point in their lives.
According to the 2011 Oklahoma Youth Risk Behavioral Survey, more than half of Oklahoma high school students have sexual intercourse. That, paired with Oklahoma ranking fifth in the nation in teenage pregnancy by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, highlight why Joe Sangerardi thinks it's important students receive sexual education before reaching a college campus.
I think that it does fall to the public education system to kind of explain people how the process works so they can be as safe as possible if they choose to.
Kathy Moxley directs OU's Women's Outreach Center. She says they've developed programs designed for undergraduates to fill those gaps in knowledge.
We have a group called Sexperts. It's made up of students here at OU who go through training, and then they do a one-hour workshop in residence halls, classrooms, with student organizations on STD, pregnancy prevention, HIV education.
But Moxley estimates they only reach between 500 and 1,000 students. Compare that to the 4,000-plus freshmen that enter OU each year, and you'll see that more than 75% of incoming students are left out. However, since all incoming students are required to complete a sexual assault online training course, would pairing sex education with that make a difference?
I mean, I think more education is helpful. I'm not sure that mandatory sex education is necessarily the way to go on a college campus. I would look for other ways for us to reach our population and make sure that information is accessible.
Like what? human sexuality professor Terry Dennison has an idea.
Yeah, I think that it has to be interactive and personalized so that people can take scientific information and really apply it to their own lives in a way that's going to work for them.
A big part of the Trojan survey is rewarding universities that acknowledge sex as a part of the college culture. You don't have to be a chemistry major to experiment in college. With the proper resources provided by the university, students can experiment safely. For Assignment Radio, I'm Brant Morrell.
As the previous story stated, sex education is not mandatory at OU, but online training about sexual assault is required. For victims, life is often filled with shame, fear, or legal battles. In our next story, Assignment Radio's Kate Carlton examines what happens to those who perpetrate these crimes after they go through the legal system.
The city of Norman lists 83 registered sex offenders within the city limits, and it would be easy to think that at least some of those people were ones who were simply caught urinating in public. After all, there's a common assumption that a man who's caught relieving himself on the street can get slapped with a felony and have to register as a sex offender. But Captain Tom Easley from the Norman Police Department insists that is not the case.
There are some misdemeanor sex offenses. And speaking in general terms, outraging public decency, urinating in public. Generally, that is a municipal charge. And basically, if you're a Norman resident on any criminal citation for a municipal violation, a misdemeanor, and with that in mind, you can sign the piece of paper just like a traffic ticket if you're a Norman resident and go on your way.
Easley explains that in Oklahoma, intent is the critical issue.
If in fact they're doing more than just peeing in public, shall we say, and it really is based on the circumstances. The most common one that you think of are the cartoon characters with the raincoat and no pants and no shirt and the shoes and socks on. And it's done with malicious intent or pure interest in mind.
The state law he refers to is the most recent version of Oklahoma's Sex Offenders Registration Act. According to this law, those convicted of a sexual felony cannot live within a 2,000-foot radius of a school. And as straightforward as that sounds, in a city that's a school metropolis like Norman, that's significantly easier said than done.
Well, we got schools everywhere, plus the University of Oklahoma, and that counts too. But what you see is the law says you cannot live there. But that's a little hazy area in the enforcement and prosecution of these folks. And really what it's come down to is somebody has described it as the grandfather clause.
This grandfather clause is a general understanding between law enforcement officials that makes it possible for sex offenders to remain inside that prohibited radius if they're convicted while living there.
In other words, if you offend in Norman, you're convicted in Norman of a sex offense that requires registration, and you have property here in town, you don't have to sell and leave that property. You can just register and stay with that property. Now, if you sell the property or dispose of it in some way, then you're stuck with a situation where now the rule kicks in on you because the grandfather clause no longer operates.
Captain Easley says there are two main reasons why Norman practices that grandfather clause. First, the state of Oklahoma is reluctant to take property from its owners. Then, there are 24 schools that are part of the Norman Public School District alone. That doesn't include the private schools and daycares that also count in the law's enforcement. So Easley says it's difficult to find land that abides by the original law unless that land is out by Lake Thunderbird. University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Sociology Meredith Worthen teaches a course on sexual deviance. She says that while this may sound alarming, she sees the grandfather clause as a more practical way to deal with sex offenders.
In our mind, whenever we think of a sex offender, we think of an offender that offends against children. Even though there's lots of types of sex offenders, that's the first image that comes to our mind. And what do we want to do? Protect the children, of course.
Not all sex offenders are pedophiles. Some are charged with statutory rape, incest, or sexual battery. Put simply, many sex offenders are not direct threats to children. And Worthen says this clause may be more beneficial to towns than it is harmful.
In particular, in the state of Florida, there's kind of this area under a bridge where all of these sex offenders live because there's nowhere in the county that they are allowed to live based on the restrictions. And that is highly problematic because it creates this group of mostly men living without any sort of access to anything that we would think of as a safe space, right? They don't have electricity, they don't have running water, and they're mad that they have to live here. And guess what they do? They sit around and they talk about how mad they are and how this is a bad situation. So those guys are not considering how they want to, you know, be good men, how they want to rejoin the population and, you know, do pro-social things because they're living under a bridge because their city said, too bad.
In this clip from ABC News, a man stuck under that bridge in Florida reflects on his living situation.
They tell me that I have to be here from 6 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock a.m. in the morning.
Do you feel like you're being punished a second time?
Of course I do. I done went to prison and did all that time. Why I'm still here? Why I'm still being punished? All I want is my life back. I deserve a second chance at life.
Worthen says that by permitting the offenders to remain in their homes after serving time, it encourages assimilation rather than recidivism.
Allowing for kind of thinking about these things differently can move away from creating these kind of hubs of spaces where criminals live in and thinking about these things in a way that kind of makes more sense to our community.
For Assignment Radio, I'm Kate Carlton.
You're listening to Assignment Radio on KGOU, your NPR source. Tulsa is known for a lot of things. Art Deco buildings, Quick Trip, Hanson. But one thing Tulsa has recently garnered international notoriety for is an extremely high number of meth labs. Assignment Radio reporter Kaylee Doherty investigates what these numbers might mean for the community and for law enforcement.
We just hope that stricter enforcement will help to lower the, you know, amount of meth incidents and fires and, you know, just bring an end to the problem.
Gina Van has been working as a technician at MedX Drug in Tulsa for the past 23 years. She's witnessed firsthand the growth of Oklahoma's meth problem. Current state law limits the amount of pseudoephedrine-containing medicine someone can buy to 7.2 grams because pseudoephedrine is a key ingredient when making meth. Van says many of her customers often try to exceed that limit.
We aren't supposed to stereotype, but seeing as many requests for it as we do, you get a general consensus that it is a huge problem.
Van says the number of rejections has gone down recently since the new tracking system was put into effect on January 1st of this year. The system tracks pseudoephedrine medication purchases in surrounding states as well as within Oklahoma. However, Van worries meth cookers are still finding other ways to get their ingredients.
You hate to think, but it seems as if, you know, they'll find a means to their end, you know, some way or another. And given the fact that we are, you know, first in the nation as far as so many meth labs, you know, it does make you wonder.
The results of CNN's 8-year study released last month, which draw from the Drug Enforcement Administration's National Register, show that Tulsa County leads the nation in the number of contaminated meth lab sites identified by police, with a total of 979. Spokesman Mark Woodward for Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics says this high ranking is actually a positive reflection on local law enforcement.
I don't think it means Tulsa County has more meth cooks than any place else. I think, one, we do a better job here in Oklahoma of tracking meth labs, because if a lab is seized, there's paperwork that's filled out and a company that comes and hauls off the materials and safely disposes of it. So we're able to track it. Number two, I think we've got aggressive law enforcement and prosecutors in the Tulsa area that are actively seeking these labs and trying to get them shut down. And so I think we're finding more labs because of complement to law enforcement. And so, again, I think those are two of the big reasons why we've seen high numbers, and they're both complements as opposed to looking at it on the surface and thinking that maybe we just have more meth cooks in that area. I think we're just finding more.
Woodward says the nationwide movement against meth really began in Oklahoma.
We were the groundbreaking agency to control phenyl acetic acid back in the late 1980s to really pretty much wipe out the old meth lab problem from the 70s and 80s. And then when the Sudafed recipe showed up, Oklahoma was the first state. Our agency ran legislation here in Oklahoma that put it in pharmacies and put limits on how much you could buy and set up a tracking system. And now that law has also been adopted by all 50 states and the federal government. So many of the groundbreaking drug legislation nationwide has started right here at the Bureau of Narcotics and with our Oklahoma legislature.
Given that current legislation just took effect, Woodward says only time will tell what kind of an impact it will make on curbing production within the state. Another, perhaps larger concern is distribution of the drug.
We estimate about 85% of the meth consumed in Oklahoma and in the United States is imported from Mexico by the cartels. But we also work at our agency. We've got an expertise that focuses on Hispanic drug cartels that are bringing ice, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana and other drugs in from Mexico. And we have shut down many of these cell groups here in Oklahoma as well. So it's really a two-pronged approach. You got to focus on those cooking it, but also those importing it. And then we'd spend a lot of time with our education division in the schools so that we can talk to kids and educate them about the dangers of drugs so that they never get on this path. And I think that's where we're going to have the most success, is when we can change the attitude of kids to get them to not begin to step on this path. That in the long term is going to have the biggest impact.
Woodward hopes the combination of efforts to limit production and distribution will lower the rankings of places like Tulsa County in future polls. But he says the numbers can fluctuate.
It could go both ways, because certainly we think that some of these measures are helping make it tougher to get, plus prosecution. A lot of these people are getting tougher sentences, and they're not back out cooking again, so that can lower it. But at the same time, with the law enforcement actively seeking these labs, there's a chance we could even find more.
Woodward says every lab shut down by law enforcement makes a difference in the community.
Every time we shut a lab down and get some kids out of there and get the people arrested and a lot of times are offered drug court, that's an opportunity for us to get these people on the right path with their lives. That's our hope.
For Assignment Radio, I'm Kaylee Doherty.
According to the Center for Disease Control, more than 90% of children entering kindergarten have been immunized with most recommended vaccines. However, there is a small percentage of Americans who believe that these vaccinations are potentially harmful. For parents, there is an uncomfortable question to face. Risk your child dying of an otherwise preventable disease, or risk potential side effects of that preventative technology? Assignment Radio's Anna Nashpal explores the issue.
A sterile building with the bright lights that smells like disinfectant, a white coat and a needle, and then finally comes the shot. This is probably the most common image that comes to someone's mind when they think of vaccines.
I think it's probably difficult to exactly pinpoint, because there's been a long-standing fear of vaccines. Some of it, I think, is just fear of not really the vaccine itself, but just fear of getting an injection. So some could just be thought side of blood, and pain can be a reason. And then some people might and are scared of getting the vaccine themselves, getting something injected, a foreign substance injected into their body.
Maggie Poole is an assistant director for clinical services at Goddard Health Center on the University of Oklahoma campus. In her 15 years of work experience, she had heard a lot of rumors and myths associated with vaccines.
I think probably the most prevalent, you could say myth or rumor, because it really hasn't been proven, is that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine causes autism. And then they're also sometimes scared that they'll actually get the disease from the vaccine. But I do think with sometimes media awareness, where they're bringing issues to light that a vaccine may cause this or this happened, you know, when there's a lot of coverage about a vaccine causing problems, it does cause people to be fearful. So I do hear some people saying, I'll never get the flu shot. I won't do it. They just will not do it.
According to the website Scholastic, a British doctor, Andrew Wakefield, observed whether vaccines could cause an autism. From the 12 children he was treating for bowel disease, 6 were also autistic, and those same 6 had had the MMR vaccine. So he made the conclusion that the vaccine was the cause of the autism. It is important to note that his conclusion was made on an observation, not a scientific study. However, he published his findings in the respected British medical journal, The Lancet, and he got a lot of media attention. Once people heard this news, they became alarmed, and even after a latest study confirmed that MMR is not linked to autism, the suspicion persisted. But the Institute of Medicine and the American Academy of Pediatrics have concluded that the MMR vaccine doesn't cause autism. However, for a more common annual vaccine, like the one for the flu, it depends which strain of the virus you get.
It is actually possible with a live flu vaccine that you do get a very mild form of the illness. Now, if you choose to get the inactivated form of the vaccine, which is the shot, there is not a way that you can get the flu. But if you were to take the live nasal vaccine that you put up your nasal passages, you can actually get a mild form of the flu. So there's a yes and a no to that question. But with the shot, which is inactivated, a dead virus, you will not get the flu.
If we look back into the history, the number of children that died or were disabled by an infection disease tracked away as vaccination became more common. Today, people are more terrified of a disease, so they are far more willing to take the risk.
It could just be people remembering stories or hearing stories over and over from family members. There was a time in the 1950s when an oral polio vaccine, actually, it's rare, it was rare, but it caused people to get polio. And so people could have heard those stories. But it's really hard to think like that now because we don't see a lot of outbreaks. So it's hard to remember. People that remember what diseases were like people remember when polio epidemic happened, they want the vaccine because they remember what the actual disease was like. But we're not seeing a lot of measles, mumps, and rubella. We're not seeing the death that they cause. So it's kind of hard to remember what it was like to have those diseases so prevalent in our society. But it could just be that people have heard stories and they're scared. And I think it's the fact of, you know, a shot is invasive. You're injecting something into the body and it scares people sometimes.
But this phobia in people increased in 2011, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The number of measles outbreaks reported into the United States quadrupled from the previous year. As the Mercola site published, this situation encouraged the people who were against vaccination to say that even though mumps and measles are innocuous childhood disease, the vaccine have caused cancer, diabetes, brain damage, leukemia, autism, and even death.
If people are so afraid that they will not get their vaccines, then we could see disease outbreak happen, and we already are seeing it. We're having the highest pertussis outbreak that we've had in 50 years. Now, some say that the reason why we're having that is because we have now better diagnostic tests, and we now know that people are having it, and maybe they've always had it, but we just didn't know it. But some say it could be a direct result of people not getting immunized.
PhD professor of psychology at MIT University from Skopje, Macedonia, Miroslav Pendarovski, explains why the fear of vaccines exists and why no amount of communication or discussion or reason will get people deeply worried about vaccines to stop worrying.
Страхот е едно од четирите базични човекови чувства. Fear is one of the four basic emotions that people have. It's inherent to the human. It's part of the human nature. Fear is one of the deepest emotions and always connected with the personal hazards in one human life. The phobia of vaccines can be caused from a negative and traumatic experience, especially when it comes to personal health. Risks are scarier when we don't have a sense of control.
As Professor Pendarovsky explains, it's the psychological tendency of people to favor information that confirms their own personal, pre-existing belief or hypothesis about something. With the information so readily available online today, it's not hard to conduct some quick results and find a community of people who agree with you, no matter what the subject or your opinion on it.
It is entirely understandable that any parent of an autistic child wants answers and hope and a sense of control over the fate they've been cruelly dealt. But today's society gives so many different kinds of vaccines that were not verified in a safe manner. And that makes people suspicious and not so comfortable when it comes to this issue. Media informs so many contradictory views that make people confused and wonder even more.
However, some parents wonder why their babies receive vaccination for diseases that do not exist today. Nurse Maggie Poole explains that these diseases are rare but still do appear, and they are highly contagious and sometimes life-threatening. Without preventative measures like vaccines, some diseases could make a comeback someday.
Now with the pertussis outbreak, I've talked to a lot of people that are coming in to get their shot because they have a newborn baby in their life and their doctor told them they need to get this shot. So I think, yeah, and the media campaigns that are out about getting the pertussis vaccine and keeping updated. So I do. I think the more that we can spread the word, the more it will help.
For Assignment Radio, I am Anna Noshpal.
Unlike measles, hepatitis B, and chickenpox, there is unfortunately no way to immunize oneself against financial hardship. Even those with good credit and a healthy savings can find themselves in a tough spot. Assignment Radio reporter Joey Adams spoke with one Oklahoman about his journey through bankruptcy.
In 2006, Joe Cunningham was just like every other guy.
I'd been working at a retail store for almost 20 years, and I had been in my house for about 10, 12 years, and I had one of the highest credit ratings you could buy. When I bought my house, she said I had the highest credit ratings she'd ever seen, and I bought a new truck, brand new boat, and I worked straight commission, but I made good money because I'd been there for so long. We got paid every 2 weeks, and my first 2 weeks' paycheck paid all my bills. So after that, everything else I had was to live off of. So, I mean, everything was great.
But like many others before him, Joe found out that life can change at the drop of a hat. What he thought was only going to be a few sick days away from work turned into something that would change his life forever.
It was about February that year, and I ended up getting sick. And I thought, man, I can't keep missing work. I just... because I'm straight commission, so I've got to go. So I went there, and I could just barely walk. I didn't have any energy, so I went to a clinic there, and they told me that I was severely anemic. So for the next 8 months, I was in and out of the hospital. I didn't know if I was going to live or die or whatever, and they did every test known to man trying to figure out what was wrong. And that year, I lost three-fourths of my income.
Despite years of saving every dime he had to pay back medical bills, Joe still found himself staring uphill at a seemingly insurmountable amount of debt. On the verge of losing everything he had ever worked for, he decided to pull his life savings out of his 401k to pay off his debt.
I had to quit my job to get my money out of my 401k. So when I quit my job, I decided, well, I'm just going to put my house up for sale. I wanted to move to southeastern Oklahoma all my life, so I moved to Broken Bow. And for the next year, my 401k money, I paid my house payment, truck, boat, everything. And I had $30,000 equity in my home, so I knew as soon as I sold that, then I'd be able to get out of debt. Well, this was 2008, and that's when the housing market crashed. And all the people that wanted to buy my house, the bank wouldn't approve. They were too scared to approve anybody.
Out of options, Joe opened the only door he had left.
Finally, it got to the point to where everything that I'd worked for my whole entire life, my good credit, everything, now it's all going to come to an end. I got with an attorney, and I went bankrupt on everything except my truck.
Unfortunately, bankruptcy has become a harsh reality for many Oklahomans, and that number is growing. In 2007, less than 9,000 Oklahomans filed for bankruptcy. In 2010, that number had grown to more than 14,000. Despite decreasing slightly since 2010, bankruptcy remains to be a problem for too many Oklahomans. Former bank president Melvin Cavender says that credit card debt is the leading cause of bankruptcy, and that it can start as soon as your 18th birthday.
Credit card companies encourage people. I'm sure when you started the college, they tried to give you three or four different companies tried to give you credit cards, and you had really no ability to pay back. But they charge you 15% to 30% interest. A lot of times if you have a debt with them, you pay $100, 80% of it's their interest, and 20% goes to your debt.
Cavender says that even with responsible credit and spending habits, bankruptcy can still sneak up on anybody.
If two people are working and one loses their job and they can't refinance to adjust their payments and outgo to their income, then they have really no other choice.
But bankruptcy doesn't mean it's the end. And Cavender says you can reestablish your credit. You just have to be willing to put in the work.
A little time needs to go by, 6 or 8 months, and you need to look at the situation, what you've got coming in now versus what you can pay out. You know, again, you're the best guy in the world, but if you make $2,000 a month, you can't pay out $2,100.
Joe Cunningham says he tries not to dwell on the past, and that now he's just taking his life one day at a time.
You know, it could be worse. I could lose my son or my parents or something like that, but, you know, I'm still blessed that I'm alive and I'm healthy, so that's what I got to try to do is just make it every day.
For Assignment Radio, this is Joey Adams.
Okay, before this last story, you might want to go ahead and get yourself a glass of water. Just talking about water conservation makes you look at this thing that you take for granted every day in a whole new light. And I personally got very thirsty after thinking about it. Assignment Radio's Ajuno Setawaldi dives into the issue.
It's a bitter cold Thursday evening at the South Dam area of Lake Thunderbird, and as the darkness sets, the brown, murky waves surge toward the shoreline, retreat, and surge again. Lake Thunderbird takes its name from the Native American legend of a supernatural bird that creates thunder with its wings and strikes lightning from its beak. Today, many locals refer to it as Lake Dirty Bird because of its murky brown water. But if the current drought in Norman continues, they may simply refer to it as Lake Dirtbird. Like most of Oklahoma's reservoirs, Lake Thunderbird is man-made. The lake's origins can be traced back to studies initially dealing with flood control at Little River and water supply concerns for the surrounding areas. In 1953, Oklahoma City, Norman, Midwest City, Dell City, Moore, and Tinker Air Force Base made a request to the Bureau of Reclamation Studies that they be included in studies for a reservoir project at a site downstream on Little River. Less than a decade later, the Central Oklahoma Master Conservancy District for Norman Project was created, and the Lake Thunderbird Reservoir was completed in 1965 as a municipal water source. But it wasn't built to last forever.
confined body of water is going to fill up with sediment. And so they do build reservoirs or any man-made lake with a 100-year life.
That's Ken Comiskey, the director of utilities for the city of Norman. He says that Lake Thunderbird is at its half-life now, and the current combination of low precipitation and high temperatures has the lake suffering.
It's just about at the lowest for this year because we're in the third year of our drought, and so it's about 7.5 feet low.
According to United States Army Corps of Engineers, the lake's conservation pool, or the amount of water devoted to public consumption, is about at 63% of its capacity. The record low was in 2006, but if this drought continues, Comiskey says we may meet and exceed the record this season.
So much of it is depending on the weather and the temperature. I mean, if you get a warm day, even in the winter, people will start to mess around outside and plant things and water things or wash their cars more often, stuff like that.
Rain means more water to use, but less water use because people stay inside, Comiskey says. And if the dry conditions we're experiencing now don't change, and they aren't expected to, it may not bode well for the coming summer and the future of Lake Thunderbird. Robert Post, the director of Oklahoma Water Survey, says today there is more pressure on Lake Thunderbird as a water source than ever before.
Norman also gets drinking water from well water, from wells that they have scattered throughout the county. However, some of those wells have arsenic concentrations that exceed the maximum contaminant levels established by the EPA for drinking water. So a number of those wells have had to be shut down, which places more stress on the use of Lake Thunderbird, because what they do basically is they blend well water and Lake Thunderbird water together in terms of supplying the needs of the citizens of Norman.
Post says city and state officials are working with water agencies to address that problem.
I think it's a serious concern among the different water agencies in the state. And so, you know, I think people are looking at that down the road in terms of how are we going to deal with this aging infrastructure? What are we going to do for the future water needs for the state? There have been new reservoirs that have been created more recently. And there are plans for other ones.
Cole says the most immediate solution is water conservation.
We as a culture and as a society waste an awful lot of water. And we use fresh, treated, potable water for needs that really don't require fresh, treated water.
The city of Norman has been implementing a mandatory stage 2 moderate conservation measure since January 14th of this year. The conservation measure prohibits all outdoor watering or irrigation between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. and requires even odd watering. It also prohibits access outside water use, like washing buildings, paved areas, and cars.
This is a unique situation for us. We've usually had to implement mandatory conservation in the summertime when the demand was the highest. This is the first time we ever had to do that in the winter.
Norman's average allocation of water from Lake Thunderbird is about 8.5 million gallons per day. According to the Central Oklahoma Master Conservancy District, Norman utilized more than 95% of its allocation from Lake Thunderbird in 2011. At the beginning of this year, the agency reduced Norman's allocation by 10%. Pohl says residents can help alleviate Lake Thunderbird's burden by conserving water indoors too.
Power companies can use non-potable water for their needs for cooling towers, and more are doing that. So homeowners could also do that in terms of reducing their water usage. The biggest water usage in a home is the toilet. And so a lot of water could be saved from people moving to low-flow toilets, low-flush toilets.
The city is also considering the option of diverting treated wastewater into tributaries that would flow into Lake Thunderbird to augment the water supply.
That's a heavy lift from the standpoint of environmental regulations and also from public perception. People tend to look disfavorably about the idea of reusing their own wastewater. But a lot of the wastewater that's treated today is actually of fairly high quality.
Pulse is working with the city to analyze the quality of water from Lake Thunderbird and compare it to treated wastewater to determine if reuse is a viable option. Pulse says if the city does get permission to reuse water, it will do additional treatment of water above and beyond what they're doing. But right now, Lake Thunderbird is still in trouble.
People should be worried because I don't think there's going to be an easy solution. I think it's going to take a lot of different efforts.
For Simon Radio, I'm Ajinder Sadawaldi.
You've been listening to Assignment Radio, a bi-weekly student-produced public affairs program focusing on news and events. The views and opinions expressed during this show are not necessarily those of KGOU or its licensee, the University of Oklahoma. I'm Meredith Everett, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the show, so please visit us on the web at kgou.org. And as always, thank you for listening.